From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is visiting the Florida Panhandle today to see the devastation left behind by Hurricane Michael. Charles Smith, in what was the small town of Mexico Beach, is grateful for the attention and the help from FEMA. As you know by now, Mexico Beach is quaint, no high-rise hotels, so Michael's direct hit nearly wiped it out. Charles Smith owns what's left of the Gulf View Motel. It was destroyed. In fact, he's in Alabama now. That's how far he says he had to drive to find a place to take a shower. Charles, we are so sorry for the destruction. And also, you stayed during the worst because you'd been through hurricanes like Opal, so you didn't realize how bad Michael would be. You must have been terrified.
Yes, ma'am. Very. I knew I was going to die. Right before that it really hit, we had no electric, so I couldn't see the TV. My neighbor called up. He stayed. But he had so much stress in his voice. He said, "Looks like we did the wrong thing." I said, "Yes, sir, we did." And he said, "Looks like this is the end." I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "It's been really good knowing you, sir."
Oh, wow.
And then the phone lines went dead.
Oh.
I held on for a little bit. I grabbed all my cats and took them downstairs, put them in one of my rooms because I figured the roof was going to blow off the top. When I went into the rooms, the water started coming up under the door and around the side of the door. My neighbor's house came through the front. Then I tried to get that cat out to put him in the stairwell, but the water was too much. I grabbed a hold of the door knob. It would not move.
Mm.
It would not. There was too much water pressure.
Mm.
Then the wall started collapsing in. I was able to get one door open. I grabbed one of my cats, just threw it in the office.
Mm.
It went up to the top stairs. I went back down for the other ones. The door slammed on me. The water went up, went from 2 feet to four to float me up to the roof.
Mm.
Then I got sucked into the laundry room with a poor cat. And then the refrigerator hit me because everything is floating. You take everything that floats and put it right about 4 feet where you're at, and it's not standing still.
It is moving. And it's a missile.
Yep.
Oh, I
got hit by beds, stoves, because I'm a motel, and I got kitchenettes, and my neighbor's house is floating in my house. I grabbed with that cat I had. I threw it in, and they came in and sucked me back out. I was able to get back into the room number two, and then the outside wall caved in once I got up on the refrigerator, because the refrigerator got sucked in and jammed into the bathroom. I was able to get back up onto the refrigerator. I went to reach for my cat. The wall broke through, and the cats just were on the bed, and they just floated out.
Oh.
And this whole time, I'm having 150, 160 mile-an-hour winds hitting me.
Hmm.
And it's not that the wind's blowing. It's what the wind's blowing. Right now, my face has got windburn. Wednesday night, it took me an hour to get the salt water out from behind my eyeballs.
Oh,
that's how hard it was. And if you ever seen wind at that speed, it is white.
Hmm.
And then I did not even hear the roof rip off the motel. I heard nothing at all. They say you hear a freight train. That was not that. You heard nothing but the wind.
It was like,
and I've been in tornadoes before.
Wow. Oh, so you sound pretty traumatized.
Yes, ma'am. I will never do that again. Never.
Oh. Look, you survived. We're very grateful for that. And now you're confronted with the future. First of all, hearing your story, do you think the death toll is going to rise?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. I mean,
definitely. They found who the people were are obvious on top of the wreckage or the floaters. Now they got to lift up everything.
Yeah.
So it's going to be higher because there's too many people just like me thinking, well, it was just like Opal, and Opal wasn't nothing.
No, Opal. I mean, I'm reading about Janet Kinch. She lost her home in Opal, lost the roof anyway. Now she lost her home again, and she just lost her husband 2 weeks ago. I mean, this town has been wounded. Do you think you're going to be able to live there again, open up the motel again? What is your thought?
Yes, I am going to come back. I don't care what it takes. I am 100% rebuilding. I owe it to my community, and I owe it to my customers that's been loyal to me for all these years.
Yeah. I'd hate to ask you, because obviously you've been, this has been such a turmoil for you, but did your cats survive?
I got two.
Yeah. Well,
two, I got to two outside, two out of six.
Two out of six.
And I tried to go to take one of them that was I got it to float it out. I found him on a pile of rubble at the top. But I tried to get him to a vet, but there was no vets to be open.
I'm just
take your animals with you.
Yeah.
Put your dogs in the cage, throw the cats in the trunk. I don't care. Put your goldfish in a bag.
Yeah. The point you're pointing to is and go yourself. Charles Smith, I'm so sorry, but thank you so much for really giving us insight into what this horror was. Thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
One of the country's iconic retailers filed for bankruptcy today. Sears has struggled to keep its hundreds of stores profitable in the face of mounting debt. But before that, the company was known for its appliances, power tools, and those thick mail order catalogs. Our next guest says that in its heyday, Sears revolutionized retail and paved the way for the company contributing to its demise. That would be Amazon. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us now. Derek, when you look at the rise and fall of Sears, when did things start to go wrong for the company?
It's an amazing story. You know, Sears was the largest retailer in the U.S. for decades. I mean, the tallest building in the U.S. for 25 years was Sears Tower in Chicago. And I want to begin by reminding people that when we look at Sears as a sort of fusty old artifact of retail, you know, old means successful. This company was around for 132 years, and that's an incredible accomplishment. But basically, the story of Sears' demise is simple. Keeping up with consumer tastes is really, really hard. Sears disrupted retail over and over again at the turn of the 20th century, in the middle of the 20th century, and then finally Sears itself was disrupted because another company came along, and first Walmart and then Amazon, that essentially had a mastery of consumer tastes and a mastery of technology that was Sears superior. And so it was essentially foisted by the very weapons that it wielded so successfully for its first many decades.
When you draw parallels between Sears and Amazon, Amazon started out selling a single product, which was books. Sears started out selling watches in the late 1800s.
The parallels are remarkable. I mean, think about it this way. If I said, here's a story. Shortly after the turn of the century, America had an enormous virtual retailer that began by selling only a single product, which made an extraordinary shift to start opening all of these physical stores around the country, and it becomes this model of operational efficiency that many see as gobbling up retail entirely within the U.S. This is, of course, a story about Amazon that a lot of people are familiar with, but it's also the story of Sears. People don't recognize the fact that even though when we think of Sears, we think, oh, well, it's just the Sears store. Sears didn't have any stores in the U.S. in 1925. By 1929, there were 300. So if you think Amazon is cropping up all over the country, just imagine the explosion of Sears in the 1920s. And Sears, again, of course, started as a virtual retailer. You looked at the consumer Bible, you picked out a watch or a dress or even a house that you wanted to buy, and then you would have it mailed to your home. It's the exact same thing.
Well, and actually, you know, we've been watching Sears' sort of slow motion disaster for some time now. We remember that the Sears Tower in Chicago used to be called the Sears Tower in Chicago. Now it's called the Willis Tower.
Willis. Yes.
But you wrote about this about a year ago, and you used the phrase, the internet before the internet, when you were talking about how Sears relied on mail to get customers.
That's exactly right. Mail, the telegraph, rail, parcel delivery, these were the technologies of the late 19th century that allowed Sears to become a store that was invisible, right? Not a store that you visited, but a store where you looked at a catalog on your couch and had items mailed to you. And it was helped in many ways by the USPS. The Postal Service had rural free delivery, and that meant that mail routes could extend all the way into rural areas, and so Sears could reach people where they were. And then eventually what happened is, as Sears saw people streaming from rural parts of the country to urban parts of the country, they said, well, we have to follow them. Mm-hmm. And it followed them with stores. So in many ways, just as Amazon is essentially a huge leverage bet on the future of commerce going virtual, Sears was also a leverage bet, a very successful leverage bet on the future of shopping being urban.
Derek, just in the 20 seconds we have left here, what's the big lesson for Amazon from what happened to Sears?
Well, the first lesson is that retail is always in a state of metamorphosis, and large technological changes that helped Sears at the early 20th century hurt Sears in the late 20th century. The second is that Sears grew by adding business after business, and it's important to remember, whether you're Amazon or any entrepreneur listening right now, adding more businesses is not the same mm-hmm. as building a better business. You have to focus on your core customer above all.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The midterms are 3 weeks away, and pundits and politicians are working hard to make predictions about how they'll turn out. We often look for predictions to tell us what will happen in politics, in the economy, in technology, and in other things. But as the saying goes, making predictions is hard, especially about the future. So how do you do it well? Joining us now is Dan Gardner, who's the author of Future Babble and Super Forecasting, the Art and Science of Prediction. Dan, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why is it that we humans always want to know what's going to happen in the future when it's really hard to do that in a lot of ways?
Yeah, it really stems from a really fundamental need. We have a need, a psychologically rooted need for control, a sense of control of our environment. And what do you need for control of your environment? You need to know. You need to know what's happening now, or if you're looking into the future, you need to know what's going to happen. And if you look into the future and you've got important questions on your mind and all you see is a swirling vortex of uncertainty, that's deeply disturbing. You have to erase that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And one way that we erase uncertainty is by turning to experts and saying, please tell me what's going to happen next.
Well, and the experts that I think of when it comes to predictions that get it pretty right, at least in the not-too-distant future, are weather forecasters. You know, I have an app that tells me in 10 minutes it's going to start raining exactly where you are right now. But, you know, where are we good at it and where are we bad at it?
Well, it's interesting that you highlight weather forecasters because, of course, people tend to make jokes about weather forecasters.
Right, that they always get things wrong.
Yeah, it's exactly the opposite. In fact, weather forecasting is the gold standard of forecasting. Now, the big difference between the weather forecasters, and one of the reasons why they are so good, and so many other domains, is that the weather forecasters know how good they are, and they know when they cannot do it. Mm-hmm. So many other domains, that's not true. People use vague language like something's probably going to happen, or that's pretty certain, or there's a good chance that. And nobody keeps track. They don't keep score. And so if you look at the big famous pundits who tend to dominate the news, mm-hmm. whether it's politics or economics or anything else, they don't actually have proven track records, scientifically scored track records. We don't know how accurate they are in the same way that we know how good a baseball player is by looking at his batting average.
And is the goal of a forecast to change the future, to be able to make a decision once you know what's going to happen or once you think you know what's going to happen that will change the outcome?
This is an absolutely essential point. Very often when you talk about forecasting, people talk about, well, how do you make an accurate forecast? But very, very often when forecasts are made, it's not actually accuracy that people are interested in. There are all sorts of other reasons why people make forecasts. So, you know, a pundit on television might be making a forecast because it's ideologically congenial for the audience. That very often happens. They might be making a forecast because it's shocking and it's interesting and entertaining. There's all sorts of these other competing interests. And one of those is to cause change. So, for example, if I warn that some terrible thing is about to happen,
right,
it's not necessarily that I believe that is, in fact, the case. It may be that I'm trying to spur others to action in order to prevent this supposed catastrophe. So we have to be careful when we're looking at a forecast. We have to ask ourselves, is this person just trying to give me the straight goods to be as accurate as possible, or do they have other interests at stake?
What are some big flops, some prediction failures that stand out in your memory?
Well, I always like to say that the 1970s were the golden era of failed predictions. It started really in 1968 with The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. It was a huge bestseller, basically said that there would be mass global starvation within a couple of decades. Wrong. And then the 1970s were absolutely stuffed with the most amazing forecasts. And happily for humanity, most of those forecasts, which were wrong, were all dismal. They all said, we're going to run out of oil.
Well, it reminds me of Y2K, right? That we all thought that the world was going to end when 2000 came along and nothing happened.
That's exactly right. Y2K was another one. There's a very long litany of these things. But, you know, one of the unfortunate aspects about forecasting is this. If I go back to old forecasts and say, hey, do you remember what that guy said 10 years ago? Well, let's take a look at what happened. And it turns out it's wrong. I can tell you from experience that people kind of yawn because it's an old forecast. Who cares about old forecasts? Old forecasts are old news. Mm-hmm. But if time passes and somebody's forecast happens to be right, then they will be introduced as the person who got it right. And we all have to listen to this person because they're going to tell us what's going to happen next. And as a result, the rule with expert predictions so often is heads I win, tails you forget we had a bet.
Right. Well, you think about that every time somebody who figured out that President Trump was going to win when much of the media thought that he would not win, when he did win, you know, there are a few journalists out there like, I said it. Look at my tweet from, you know, 2 months ago. I said it was going to happen.
Yep. And, you know, look, it's there's an old saying about, you know, mutual funds. You know, you start 500 mutual funds and you just bet on all sorts of different stocks. And by sheer happenstance, one or two of them will hit big. And then you hold up your one or two that hit big and you say, look at this. What a brilliant investor I am. Well, forecasts very often function like that. You can't judge the quality of a forecaster by a single forecast.
That's Dan Gardner, who is author of the book Future Babble and co-author of Super Forecasting, the Art and Science of Prediction. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And let us know what you think of forecasts, political and otherwise, at hereandnow.org. The famous Santa Ana winds blew into Southern California today, prompting the National Weather Service to issue a red alert for fire danger. In late July, the Carr Fire swept through parts of the city of Redding and the surrounding area, and today residents are faced with burned hillsides and more than 1,000 home sites contaminated with toxic ash. Leah Moriarty from Jefferson Public Radio reports.
I'm just off Keswick Dam Road on the western edge of Redding. The Carr Fire blasted through this neighborhood on the evening of July 26th, incinerating dozens of homes. On this day, a crew in white hazmat suits and respirators is methodically sifting through the ash and rubble. Ivan Rodriguez with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control says this is phase one of the cleanup.
That entails screening the properties that have been devastated by the fire and looking at household hazardous waste that needs to be removed to allow for the ash and debris to go off in a future time.
Rodriguez says the typical American home contains a whole range of products that can cause toxic contamination after a fire.
We're looking for compressed gas cylinders, we're looking for batteries, looking for any paints, any solvents, any pesticides, herbicides.
The hazmat workers are marking what they find with spray paint to signal the removal crews. White paint for propane tanks and other standard hazardous wastes. Pink for asbestos, which requires its own special removal techniques. Once phase one is complete, crews will collect the ash and rubble, including the building's foundation, and haul it all off to a hazardous waste facility. The danger of toxic ash blowing across the landscape gives this job a sense of urgency. But there are other post-fire threats as well.
We're on the back deck of my house.
Daniel Whitley is standing behind his home in the Lake Redding Estates neighborhood, where many homes were damaged or destroyed. Whitley's was nearly one of them.
We're looking at the remnants of the Carr Fire that came perilously close to the back of the house.
As he points to the burned hillside right out his back door, he talks about his plans to head off the erosion that winter rains are likely to cause.
I'll put in some straw wattles, those long straw-filled flexible things, and then I'm going to plant some perennial bunch grasses up there.
Whitley says if he can get the grasses established before winter, he thinks he can avoid potential mudslides. Drew Coe says that in some of Redding's burned-over hillside neighborhoods, so-called debris flows could well be a danger.
You can have essentially a large mass of rock and mud and water moving down, and it can wipe out a house.
Ko was with CAL FIRE's Watershed Emergency Response Team. The group of hydrologists, soil scientists, and other experts uses sophisticated digital mapping tools and on-site observation to identify populated areas at risk for landslides and other post-fire hazards to safety and property. He says the size of the CAR FIRE and the geological conditions in Redding mean the threats here aren't as dire as after last year's massive Thomas Fire in Southern California.
We don't have large concentrations of populations just downstream of watersheds that can really respond in a high magnitude way to storms following wildfire. We don't have a Montecito here.
Montecito, on the coast just north of Los Angeles, was hit with monster mudslides last January when heavy rains fell unburned over hillsides. Nearly two dozen people died. But risks to people and their homes aren't the only erosion concern.
We are looking at Upper Clear Creek, and across from us is actually one of our restoration projects.
Tricia Bratcher is a biologist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. She says her agency and others have spent a lot of time, effort, and money restoring this creek so salmon and other threatened fish can recover. Now she and her colleagues are worried the post-fire hillsides, denuded of vegetation, could undo some of those gains by allowing ash and fine sediment to wash into the creek and clog up the nests where salmon lay their eggs.
You need water moving through that nest to bring in dissolved oxygen. And if it's full of sand and fines, it smothers the eggs and they die.
Clint Snyder with the Regional Water Quality Control Board adds that ash from burned homes often contains heavy metals and other toxins. And he says,
as those metals move into the stream systems, then we have the potential to further impact salmonids and other organisms from a toxicity standpoint.
Snyder says efforts to prevent erosion into those streams is crucial to minimizing the harm that sediments and toxins could do to fish. Right now, the clock is ticking, and efforts to get hillsides stabilized and contaminated sites cleaned up are in full swing. How soon winter rains arrive and how heavily they fall will go a long way toward determining how much damage the CAR FIRE continues to cause long after the flames are doused. For Here and Now, I'm Liam Moriarty, reporting from Redding, California.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Today, President Trump said he's sending Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to meet Saudi Arabia's King Salman to talk about the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, missing since he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul nearly 2 weeks ago. President Trump said that in his conversation with the king today, the king denied his government was behind the suspected killing of this critic of his regime. Here's Trump's conclusion.
It sounded to me like maybe these could have been rogue killers. Who knows? We're going to try getting to the bottom of it very soon, but his was a flat denial.
NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has been following this. Jackie, this is a fast-moving story, but a rogue killer in a consulate, a killer who somehow gets a body out of a consulate, what is the latest on the president's thinking?
Well, the latest in this story, actually, more along the lines, is about a dozen Turkish and Saudi investigators have entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul right now. And that was, as you say, the last place that Jamal Khashoggi was seen. And they're doing a search of the consulate, and they've brought along a crime scene investigative van. They brought the in tow. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had offered investigators to search the consulate a few days after Khashoggi went missing. So it's taken about a week and a half to get investigators in there and get the search underway. And Saudi Arabia may have finally allowed it to go ahead as a way to calm rising tensions between the kingdom and the U.S.
Yeah. Well, on 60 Minutes last night, the president promised severe punishment if Saudi Arabia is behind Khashoggi's disappearance and possible death. But today he says maybe it's rogue killers. He also said last night on 60 Minutes he didn't want to halt a proposed $110 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia as punishment, as some are suggesting, because that would hurt American manufacturers. And he said everybody in the world wants that order. He said this before, including Russia and China. Is that true?
Yes, just to clarify a couple of things. First of all, a lot of analysts say that the arms deal is worth a lot, no question, but that the $110 billion figure being bandied around by Trump is really inflated. And a lot of the deals are just letters of intent, not actual signed deals. And many of them, in fact, started during the Obama administration. But I think the president is right that Russia and China would be interested in selling weaponry to Saudi Arabia. It's a very rich country, and it's always looking for arms. But whether the kingdom itself would want to buy those U.S. arms, buy the Russian or Chinese over buying U.S. arms, is really another story. You know, the fact is, it's unlikely Saudi Arabia wants to annoy or alienate the U.S. It's a very important ally to the royal family.
How is this going over in the region?
Well, in Saudi Arabia, I mean, you're getting a completely different picture than you are really in the rest of the world. It's very much that the world is against Saudi Arabia, that, you know, basically rogue killers were involved with that. The Saudi royal family had nothing to do with the whole incident. You know, and then they're getting some of that backing from the United Arab Emirates, as well as Bahrain, which are very close allies with Saudi Arabia. But, you know, as the rest of the world is looking at this as an international crisis, and the disappearance and perhaps murder of Jamal Khashoggi has really touched a nerve worldwide.
Yeah. Well, and as you mentioned, that the region is viewing it, or at least in Saudi Arabia, they're viewing it as possibly rogue killers. We heard the president pick up on that theme today. NPR's international affairs correspondent, Jackie Northam, thanks as always. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A quick but important correction. In our conversation with the BBC's Jeremy Bowen on Friday, he said that Israel shot down that Russian jet over Syria in September. Now, the Kremlin did initially blame the incident on Israel, but later attributed it to a chain of tragic circumstances and said Syrian forces accidentally shot down the Russian plane, killing all of the 15 Russian service members on board. So we regret that error. And now looking ahead, Election Day is 22 days away, and there's a big race for governor in the smallest state. In Rhode Island, the incumbent, the Democrat Gina Raimondo, is up against the Republican Alan Fung. Raimondo beat Fung 4 years ago, and in this year's rematch, the economy is still front and center. Here now is Peter O'Dowd reports.
Factories like Salvador Tool and Findings in Providence are remnants of Rhode Island's once glittering manufacturing industry.
Hola, un momento.
Kimberly Salvador is on the factory floor of the family business. The jewelry her workers are stamping out of metal will be sold all over the world.
She's taken this piece and she just pierced out that. So now it's
there's a chunk of metal sort of in between the stem of a flower. So
yeah,
it goes from being a big chunk of metal to a beautiful, intricate flower.
Yeah, it'll be a square. Then it'll cut the outline, and then it'll cut all in between it.
A few decades ago, as much as 80% of the costume jewelry sold in the U.S. was made here in Providence. And a third of the state's workforce had a job in manufacturing. But globalization and the Great Recession nearly wiped out Rhode Island's famed industry.
It has the reputation as being the costume jewelry capital of the world. In the 20s, this area of Rhode Island went from a textile industry into manufacturing jewelry parts and findings, and those textile mills became the factories. The building that we're in right now was a textile mill, and then it was a bakery, and now it was Sage Manufacturing, a company that we purchased.
This was the industry in Rhode Island. How
it is still the industry in Rhode Island.
But it's changed a lot, hasn't it?
It has changed a lot, and a lot of people would say manufacturing in the U.S., you know, has diminished. And my response to that is there was a time when it struggled. But anyone you talk to that knows anything will say it's coming back, that people aren't that satisfied with going overseas and they prefer to have something made in the USA.
Are you happy with the direction that the state is going?
I am. I think we could do better, but I think that gets into politics and I'm not going there.
But the politicians are.
When I ran for governor, we had one of the highest unemployment rates in the country.
At a recent debate, Gina Raimondo took credit for bringing Rhode Island out of the recession.
In fact, for most of the year that I ran, we had the highest unemployment rate in the country. In some industries, like the building trades, unemployment was over 20%. People were hurting. So I did get to work. I got to work changing the way we do economic development.
What she means is tax breaks. Raimondo lured big companies like Johnson & Johnson and a division of GE with generous financial incentives. Her opponent, Alan Fung, who is mayor of the city of Cranston, is not impressed.
The culture that the governor subscribes to of corporate welfare, those millions that have been given for many developments that produce only a few construction jobs, no long-term jobs, that's going to be dramatically reformed and many of those millions are going to be cut.
And Fung has his own challenges. In this blue state, he has to tout his conservative credentials without hewing too closely to President Trump. And then there's this wild card.
Do you deny or acknowledge you draw votes from Mr. Fung?
I want to draw votes from the both of them.
Joe Trillo is running as an independent, and he could get a big chunk of conservative votes at Fung's expense. Trillo was the chair of President Trump's 2016 campaign in Rhode Island.
I'm not in it as a spoiler, and I would look right in their eyes and tell them that. I'm tired of the party politics.
So how will those three candidates do in the race for Rhode Island's governor? To get some answers to that question, I went to this very busy street corner in downtown Providence. Of course, it's the capital of this tiny little state. And I asked Maureen Moakley for some guidance. She's a political scientist, and she's been following politics in this state for a very long time.
I've lived in Rhode Island for 33 years.
So you know the lay of the land?
Pretty much, yeah.
Why did you bring me right here in this spot in downtown Providence?
I thought if we were talking about this race, this would be a good place to illustrate some of the changes that have gone on in the past decade, say. We were in the worst shape after and during the recession. We were at the bottom. And we were the last to come out of the recession.
Now, I've heard this a couple of times talking to Rhode Islanders. You were the first to go in, and you were one of the last to come out.
Right. And I think that's because we had a workforce that was relatively untrained for new technology. But up until fairly recently, they were able to make a living in manufacturing, a good middle-class living, have cottages, little cottages down at the shore and things like that. But all that changed, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. And so when the recession hit, we really weren't prepared for what was coming. And it really hit us very hard.
How much did that pain affect the political psyche of the people here?
I think they were pretty cynical about politics because we had been so long at a disadvantage economically. And people had promised things and not a lot of big changes occurred. In addition to that, there was a sort of a Hail Mary pass made by the last administration, Republican administration, that attempted to fund with state funds a gaming sort of video game for Curt Schilling that went bust.
And the Boston Red Sox pitcher.
The Boston Red Sox pitcher. It cost us over $90 million initially. We got some of the money back. But that really gave people a jaded perspective on economic redevelopment and what people were doing. So added to the long downturn and sort of deep recession we had, this was an attempt to pull us out, and it failed, and it left people pretty cynical.
And yet here we are today, 2018, we're about to come up on the midterm elections and a big gubernatorial election here in Rhode Island, and we see construction crews here, hard at work on a project.
You're right. Well, the thing is, we are in a good spot now. In other words, we have come out of this recession. Our unemployment numbers are above the national average. I think that's why you see all these cranes in the sky and so forth.
Let's talk about Alan Fung. He is a Republican, and the polls do show Raimondo ahead, but not by that much. Is that a surprise to you in a blue state like this?
It is going to be an interesting race. It's not going to be a cakewalk for Gina Raimondo. She's going to have to work really hard, and she's going to have to get out her voters. So in that sense, I am not surprised. There are people in this state who are concerned about old Rhode Island, what it was like, and Alan Fung's message resonates with them.
got a good story.
He's got a good story. He's the son of Chinese immigrants. He worked in a Chinese restaurant. He went to the local college, where she is Yale, Harvard, Rhodes. So it's a very, very different picture.
The most recent University of New Hampshire poll, which came out after my conversation with Maureen Moakley, has Raimondo pulling ahead. But even in deep blue New England, you can't discount the conservative vote. And there are pockets of Rhode Island where Fung will do well.
We're walking buddies.
We're walking friends. Yeah. 4 miles a day. Rain, snow, sleet.
Right here in this park.
In this park.
I met Fung's supporter Ron Ancone and his friend Alan Shagnon on their daily walk around a pretty little park in the city of Johnston. Trump beat Hillary Clinton here by 14 points 2 years ago. What are you leaning towards right now?
I'm leaning towards Fung, yes.
And why is that?
Because we need change. Change of leadership.
What's wrong with the way the state's going now?
Bankrupt. The pension funds are not funded. That's the problem.
Oh, now you brought up a very controversial point, Gina Raimondo and what she did with the pensions. Is that something that still bothers you?
That still bothers me. And people that I work with that have pensions that have been cut, it's wrong.
Back when Gina Raimondo was state treasurer and Rhode Island was bleeding cash, she cut cost of living increases for Rhode Island's pension system. And on that issue, memories are long. But for 25-year-old Amanda Mercadante, who's also breaking a sweat on her morning walk, the choice is clear.
I'm a big Gina fan. I just like that the economy has gotten better with her. We can actually see results. She cares about schools.
You think she deserves the credit for the economy?
I think she's done a lot, and I would give her a good deal of the credit.
The question is how many people will agree with her in November. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Talks between the UK and the European Union broke up yesterday without a deal, just a few days before a key summit on Brexit. The Irish border remains the key stumbling block. Northern Ireland is part of the UK. The Republic of Ireland is not. So there's concern that there will be a hard border between the two when the UK is no longer part of the EU. Border issues could also affect collaborations between scientific researchers in the UK and the EU. And joining us now to talk about that is Professor Mark Walpart, who is Chief Executive of UK Research and Innovation. That's the government agency that oversees some $9 billion in public funding for research and innovation. Professor Walpart, Sir Walpart, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm pleased to be here.
And how concerned are you about Brexit and the impact of Brexit on research?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that research and innovation is a worldwide activity. One of the reasons I'm here is that we have many, many collaborations with the United States, but indeed countries around the world. But of course, Europe is an extraordinarily important partner. We have very many scientific and innovation, research innovation partnerships across Europe. And those will continue.
But will it be more difficult for researchers from mainland Europe to work with researchers in the UK after Brexit?
Well, I mean, the answer is that it shouldn't be. The government has indicated that mobility for the sort of people that are working in research and innovation will remain possible. But, you know, it is a big disruptive process. And science and innovation is only part of it. It depends on an overall deal being done.
What are your concerns right now?
My main concerns are about people, actually. At the end of the day, UK research and innovation is an extraordinary international activity. You go to any university, you go to any laboratory in the UK, and you will find people from all over the world, including very many people from Europe, because, of course, geographically, it is our closest partner. That it's really important that that continues. And, I mean, of course, it's in the same United States.
Are you in the United States in part because you want to do more collaboration with people in the United States, especially after Brexit?
It's not simply about a compensation. No, we're here because actually the truth is that the US is our number one international partner. So, you know, we're building on extremely strong and deep relationships. The Nobel Prize for Chemistry had a British scientist, Sir Greg Winter, working at the Laboratory of Molecular Biology, two American scientists working in the same area. And in fact, it's the 12th Nobel Prize for research done in the Laboratory of Molecular Biology since the 1950s, quite an extraordinary record.
So where are the UK and the US collaborating right now?
In an enormous number of areas. So many scientists have sort of formed bottom-up collaborations. But it's just exactly a year ago that the first ever UK-US science and technology agreement was signed. And there are some very important big international projects. So the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, we are the major international collaborator on that. We're working together on understanding what's going on in the Antarctic under a glacier called the Thwaites Glacier. And in the arts and humanities, there's an important collaboration between our Arts and Humanities Research Council and the Smithsonian. And in fact, just yesterday morning, I was at a meeting of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences talking about truth, trust and expertise. Seriously important topics at a time when publics are questioning expertise. They're challenging truth. And this is a time when we really need to jointly engage with our publics.
What's the most exciting thing that you're looking at right now in terms of research that's going on?
Well, you look across the whole spectrum of research. It is an extraordinary time for research. So in the UK, we've got extraordinarily strong quantum technologies. Almost every area you look at is absolutely thriving. And one of the important things, one of the things that motivated the formation of UK Research Innovation is that increasingly research requires multidisciplinary teams. You can do research at a scale that was never done before. But the real challenge is to take knowledge and turn it into public benefit. That's what actually all our funding, it's £7.5 billion a year, comes from the taxpayer. And the taxpayer needs to see not only the knowledge, but that knowledge turned into utility. So the challenge and the opportunity for all of us is to develop the new services, the new products, the new policies.
A big part of innovation, obviously, is medical innovation. And I want to ask you another question, therefore, about Brexit. There are questions about medicines that the UK will need if this breakup happens, as people think that it will. There's a question about insulin. None of it is made in the UK. A lot of people with diabetes are worried about getting insulin into the UK after Brexit. Is that a concern of yours?
That's a trade issue, and my job is not predominantly a trade issue, but what I'd say is that there's a great deal of mutual interdependence between all of the amongst all of the European countries and indeed global supply chains. And so, you know, it's not a question of looking at it through the lens of one product alone. It's a question of looking at all the things that are made in the UK that we export around the world. But as I say, my job is to be responsible for the funding of research and innovation. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole series of questions about trade which are not in my domain.
That's Sir Mark Walport, who is Chief Executive of UK Research and Innovation. Professor Walport, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.